have a much more explicit partnership of clinicians with patients and advocacy groups in prioritization of uncertainty in clinical medicine. And they've done this 3 or 4 times. They have a very prolonged process that can take 1 to 2 years. And that was one of the concerns that I had, is that what they do sounds great, but it takes a really long time. Next slide. So the work we've done for AHRQ, I'm making no claims that this is the best way to do it, but it's a way to do it and gives us something to react to. Now, this work was published in Annals of Internal Medicine. First author is Stephanie Chang, like 2 weeks ago. Is the evidence-based practice centers took these systematic review gaps in number one on the arrow, and we identified stakeholders, and the stakeholders ranged from researchers to NIH project officers to the FDA to advocacy groups to patients, and we'll get to how to identify a patient in a bit, and got them on a webinar and a conference call similar to this, and had them read the systematic review, and then we identified gaps from the systematic review. But when we went through it again, usually we found like double the number of gaps that the authors identified. And then the stakeholders also identified gaps as well. Then we went through usually a 2-stage priority ranking exercise. So we're starting from a systematic review here, and Paul's going to talk about some other ways to do prioritization where you may not have necessarily be starting from a systematic review. Then we transformed them to research questions, ranked them again, and then talked about how might you actually answer the question. So this process took 4 to 5 months, but we actually sort of forced marched it through, and we actually could get from the systematic review, assuming it's been done, to a document saying what the future research needs are in a reasonable period of time. Next slide is stakeholder engagement. And an early issue you need to decide is what's the role of your stakeholder panel. And again, we took a broad view of stakeholders. One or two of the EPCs had manufacturers at the table as well. That raises some tricky issues of if you're going to have one manufacturer, you probably need to have all the manufacturers. Are they advisory to the investigators, or do you take their word as determinative? And it can be a fairly long list. And an issue that we've all grappled with is advocacy groups are great, but are they supplemental to talking directly to caregivers and patients? Yeah. Or are they actually instead of caregivers and patients on the assumption that they give you a synthesis of the views of patients. If you are going to go directly to patients, how do you find them? There are some interesting HIPAA issues there. And there's a lot of heterogeneity in how people are doing that and how IRBs and privacy groups are handling that. An area of real need that I know PCORI is trying to deal with is how much orientation do they need? If you've never read a systematic review and don't know what one is, the input is going to be a lot less valuable than if they have some training. Almost by definition, the stakeholders all have conflicts of interest or some sort of competing interest. And the tack we've taken is they need to be declared and potentially balanced, but if you have people with no competing interests, you have a lot less interesting conversation. Next slide, the identification of the research gaps. This definition comes from the Hopkins EPC as a topic or area for which missing or inadequate information limits the ability of the systematic reviewer or the reader to reach a conclusion for a given question. And we worked with an analytic framework, boxes and arrows, usually pretty simple stuff, but we found that actually helped. And an interesting issue is the stakeholders identify gaps we missed. Now, some of those gaps are absolutely derived from the key questions in the systematic review, but some of them were way outside of scope. But they're still interesting questions, and it's we found we needed to plan a lot more in advance for how to manage those out-of-scope ideas, because we couldn't say, since we didn't know the literature of their idea behind that idea that may have been related to a completely different clinical or health policy question, whether that was actually a gap or not. So we developed sort of a parking lot to put those in. We're an evidence-based practice center, so we work a lot with something called the GRADE Strength of Evidence Rating System, and we try to make our gaps refer back to the GRADE system just to try to keep the terminology consistent. And we've got sort of four rough types of inadequate information, where it may be not enough information, it may not be precise, it may be biased, it may be inconsistent, or it may be the wrong population or the wrong outcome. And most of the gaps, plus methods, we can put into one of those four or five buckets. We've played around with various methods of doing the priority ranking. Next slide. And these gaps, often we would wind up with anywhere from 15 to 50 gaps. So simply publishing those and putting them on a website isn't helping very much. We've talked a bit about crowdsourcing, broad internet data gathering. And for this type of rating, we've kept away from that because it's derived from a systematic review, and we think some element of orientation and training is needed, but we've actually never tested that. The various EPCs have used multiple ways of doing the priority ranking, and this gets into social science, ranging from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, which gets hard if you're using more than 10. We've used Likert scales that have pros and cons. People like them, but you can wind up with ceiling effect if they like everything. We've played around with what we call multi-voting, and I'll give you an example of that. But then there's other methods such as pairwise comparisons, and the somewhat more time-consuming Delphi methods or consensus. Next slide. I'm not going to go into this in any detail. We made it fairly structured when we transformed them into a researchable question. And we use the PCOTS framework, which is common in patient-centered outcome research, to try to define what the population, the intervention, the comparator, and the outcome are. Next slide. But really the issues are, we don't know yet, and I think we need to find out, is whether arriving at these gaps, structuring them, will they resonate with funders, advocacy groups, and policymakers? Otherwise, it's much more of an academic exercise. And I think we need to try out various formats and dissemination methods of this with PCORI, NIH, and others. I did a variation on this presentation at the ARC annual meeting a week or two ago, and some members of the audience, and there were some NIH people in the audience, said, this is great, sounds very helpful, and others said, we're doing just fine the way we are now, thank you very much. Post your slide somewhere. Next slide. So, just an example, we recently published one on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You start from the key questions. I'm not going to read these. You've got the slides. We started with 20 gaps. After the stakeholder input, we sort of exploded some of them out, and they found some new gaps, so we got up to 29. After two rounds of ranking, pretty easily we got to 8 top gaps. And next slide. We use a web-based multi-voting program. So this is pretty common, where we would give them this list of gaps, and they would have a certain number of votes or stars, and they can put 3 or 4 stars against each of them. But when their stars are up, they can't prioritize anymore. So it essentially forces them to pick their top 3 or 4. And user satisfaction was pretty good, but there's other ways to do this. I'm not saying this is best. Next slide. At the end of the day, they look like this. We wind up with a research question. And at the bottom is the question for children less than 6 years of age with disruptive behavior disorder, or ADHD, what is the comparative efficacy and effectiveness of specific psychosocial treatments alone compared with pharmacologic treatments alone or in combination? And we had a long list of the outcomes. And at least in the ADHD example we used, the stakeholders were very helpful in picking the right outcomes because they steered us away from using psychometrically good scales of how jittery the kids were and looking more at patient appropriate outcomes, such as how they were doing in school. Next slide. We did go through an exercise of thinking about what the right study design would be. I'm not sure whether we're going to keep that up or not as this moves forward, because this has to be, if you only have 4 months, pretty quick and dirty to think about what would the right type of trial or quasi-experimental design be? And what would the sample size considerations be? We did find, when you're thinking about comparative effectiveness or patient-centered outcome research, a little bit of real-life orientation about what the sample sizes might be was actually quite helpful, because it's way too easy as an intellectual exercise to say, just do a bigger trial, because you can wind up with sample sizes that are quite large. Because by definition, if you have an active comparator in comparative effectiveness research, the delta, the effect size you're looking for may be less. So in terms of where to go with this, there's a bunch of groups out there conducting work in this area. I think PCORI is going to fund work in this area. I think there are some common aspects when we looked across the various groups working in this area.
Advance the slide, please.
Sorry, state of the science. Thank you, Paul. So there are a lot of groups working in this area, not a lot, but at least three or four. I think there are some common areas where we have consensus, such as what's a gap. I think there's broad consensus on what a stakeholder panel should be, as well as issues like you don't want to have one patient on your stakeholder panel. There was some discussion about whether you want to have a separate panel just for the patients to get them to talk more, and that would be something certainly one could test. There's consensus about need to train stakeholders, and not just the patients, but the other stakeholders as well, but not consensus on how to do it. And an area that we need consensus on, should we be putting study design considerations in these exercises? So I think it is possible to do this, and it's actually sort of fun.
Okay.
When my guess as to what the next steps might be, I think we need to look at what different stakeholder panel sizes and compositions should be. I know the AIR, American Institutes for Research, is doing this community citizens forum contract for AHRQ. They're in the field now, testing out different stakeholder panel size. Whether we need to look at reliability is an interesting issue. It sort of seemed obvious to us that, yes, you would want to look at reliability, but you may not get the same prioritization just depending on who's at the table, which I think, in my mind, makes me think that these are advisory rather than determinative panels. We need to test different methods of prioritization about what's most efficient, transparent. The role of quantitative methods of prioritization, and there's been a lot of talk about this on the PCORI side, like value of information analysis, which David Meltzer is a big fan of and publishes a lot in this area, which is a decision analytic technique. It's unclear what the role of that is. It takes longer, and you need very specialized expertise. And we need to identify best practices for training stakeholders. And I think that's it. And I had a lot of acknowledgments for colleagues. I can take a couple of questions. Well, thanks very much.
So in summary, what would you say is, sorry if this is really broad, but in summary, what would you say is the most important function of the stakeholder engagement?
What's the most important what of stakeholder?
Function of stakeholder engagement for PCORI.
I think to help with, there's two functions. One is, what are the important outcomes? And are the outcomes ones that are important to real-life patients? Looking at some of the reviews we at our shop have gotten back from PCORI of grants that they didn't like, which is a pretty long list, if one goes in saying, we're going to look at an intermediate outcome of glycosylated hemoglobin or something like that, they want to hear real life what's important to patients rather than a scale or a physiologic measure, unless the physiologic measure really has not a dotted line, but a hard line to an outcome that's going to matter for patients. The other is, what's an important question to ask? And I think they really want stakeholders, and that could be advocacy groups, to help us say that this is an important question to ask. simply NIH saying it's an important question to ask isn't going to fly with them.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
And you had mentioned the ethical issues of involving our patients. Can you, and I know you've been working on getting IRBs approaches or support for that, can you tell us all what that's about?
The patients, when they become stakeholders, in the PCORI sense, this is not a focus group. If I get them together as a focus group and want to hear, you know, about their lived experiences with disease, whatever, then they're subjects and we do the usual IRB. When they're a stakeholder, they actually become a collaborator. And then they're not research subjects. And the IRB, at least so far when I've talked with our IRB chairs, they've said that's not research, that they are a collaborator with you. Now, there is one tricky issue where we do a lot of mental health work, and we have had examples of stakeholders who are representatives of advocacy groups who just started telling us about the last time they stopped their medications for bipolar disorder. And we call that inadvertent disclosure, and we actually did do a very brief IRB submission to talk about that. And it sort of covered us, frankly. We do train the stakeholders in advance that we really don't want to hear about their personal health experiences unless they want to sort of encrypt it a little bit and talk about their best friend who stopped their meds. The second issue is how do you find the patients if you're looking through your electronic medical record? And that's not an IRB issue, that's a HIPAA issue. And it's a bit tricky if I ask a patient who I know and just verbally say, Mr. Jones, I saw you today and you have multiple myeloma, would you be willing to join this panel? That's just fine from a HIPAA issue. If I start rummaging through my EMR and doing research preparatory, that requires some HIPAA steps with the institution.
Yes. So Tim, let me ask a question. I was going to exactly come on that. So if the first guy moves into the collaborator role, doesn't that raise an IRB issue if his provider is also a member of the collaborating team?
I haven't gotten a straight answer out of my IRB yet, and I bet we're going to get a lot of heterogeneity across IRBs on that.
I'm pretty sure that at the VA, our IRB would say that you have to put something in place to deal with that, because in terms of identifying these guys, either the docs who are on the team are identifying from them from their own patients, for which they don't need HIPAA authorization to do,
right.
But now they run the risk of there's a conflict of interest because their provider is also a member of the collaborating team, or you have to identify them the way that you just suggested, where you're looking through the records and they're not your patient, in which case then it has to be, at least at IRB, you'd have to get a waiver of consent in order to be able to do that, or you're going to identify them through flyers, in which case it would also have to be something that was IRB approved.
So we have not actually dealt with if they are a collaborator on the project. So far, I've been told that would not be considered essentially inappropriate influence because they're not a subject. That wouldn't, because
okay.
They're not a research subject.
Maybe.
But I bet we're going to get different answers from different IRBs. And I think it's interesting that PCORI essentially is pushing us to look at this area. Thanks very much, and I got to run. Sorry, Paul.
Okay, yeah, see ya.
Bye-bye.
You can go ahead with you, Dr. Shakel.
Sure.
We'll just get your slides up.
All right, so this is, I'm Paul Shakel. Again, obviously, I'm from the environment. If it wasn't a clinic day, I would be over there at Broxton to be able to present this in person. I'm not a professor at the Pardee Rand Graduate School, at least not to my knowledge, so you can ignore that bit on there. I only have two slides, and mine is going to be like totally more random than Tim's was. And there'll be lots of opportunities for discussion. So can you put up the first slide, please? Yeah, okay, so, I mean, like I said, this is basically a collection of stuff that I've come across in the 20 years or so that I've been doing this. Some of it I've only known about from reading about it, and some I've been personally involved with. So, And these aren't, I mean, TIMS were all focused around future research needs. These are kind of like a potpourri of things, right? Okay, so that back in the, one of the first ones that I know about that tried to do this in a pretty big way, in a policy relevant way, was the Oregon Medicaid experiment from the early 1990s. And for the people that aren't familiar with this, just very briefly, their idea was is to take the same amount of money that they were currently spending on Medicaid and instead broaden it out to all the people who were uninsured in Oregon. So it was going to dramatically expand the number of people who had insurance. But in order to keep it revenue neutral, expenditure neutral, they were going to not pay for everything. Okay, so there was, you know, this is the, you know, what's the basic benefit plan? And so, their idea was that they were going to rank order all the 537 things that that they pay for and currently, and then that they were going to go down the line to how much money they had and draw a line, and everything above the line was going to get paid for and everything below the line wasn't going to get paid for. And so they did this rank ordering in a couple of different ways. They tried to do standard cost effectiveness analysis, but then they also went around and they talked to patients or proto patients, people who could be patients, and said, you know, like, how do you value various different things? And it sort of worked, but people said that there are some apparent problems with it. So that certain kind of things like TMJ prostheses, or the thing that you wear in your mouth, or certain kinds of cosmetic surgery got ranked higher on the rank order list than did like removing your appendix in acute appendicitis. And so people pointed out what some of these problems were. And ultimately, that experiment never got off the ground. Obviously, they've done a new experiment just in the last few years that's along the same line. So don't confuse those two. But there was a worry there that patients were that you might have needed to do some training with the patients in order to get them to understand these issues. Then, of course, in the mid-90s, the old AHCPR, the forerunner of AHRQ, produced about 20-some-odd guidelines, all right? And these were multidisciplinary groups, and they each had a patient. And I was a part of the back pain guideline, and that had a patient who was from the patient representative world, right? So he was somebody who is one of the big patient advocacy groups, and his role, he didn't have a particularly formal role, but he sort of chimed in, you know, when he thought he had something to add in, and because he was from the patient advocacy group, he had a more than an average working knowledge of a lot of the medical terms and a lot of the issues. But of course that AHCPR process died, right? And has not been resuscitated. Then in the UK, I mean, Tim alluded to this already. The National Institute of Clinical Excellence, they have quite an extensive stakeholder program, okay, with standing panels of representative population from the UK to help sort of decide like what guidelines or we need to develop things for, talking about what outcomes are important, et cetera, et cetera. So they have a pretty extensive process, and you can read about it on the internet. At least to the people that I've talked with, I don't have an intuitive feel for how it works, and other than to say that I think that in the UK, you're probably going to be able to get away with the concept of a limited group, and I believe the number is 20 or 30 individuals fairly representing the diversity of a country like England, then you would be able to get away with 20 or 30 people representing the diversity in a country like America. Tim talked a little bit about the stakeholder involvement in the AHRQ Effective Healthcare Program. That's about the future research needs. It also happens at multiple steps along the way, so topics get posted for public comment, for whether the topic is something that's of interest. Then the protocol gets posted for public comment. Then the draft report gets posted for public comment. And all of these things are ways that allow stakeholders to provide input along the way. And both of these last two bullet points, the UK NICE and the AHRQ one, I should make the point, have two different kinds of potential ways for stakeholder input. One is through the targeted method. That's where you're going out and you're asking specific stakeholders to be part of the process or to comment on what it is that you're doing. And then there's the general thing, which is where you're posting it for public comment. I mean, you know, it goes up there and anybody can respond to it, right? And then the last bullet point on this slide is the Guidelines International Network, and they have a section of their website that's devoted to what is sort of they have together right now about involving the public in the development of practice guidelines, because they are a practice guidelines organization. And, of course, the Institute of Medicine report that came out last year on Guidelines We Can Trust said that getting patients involved in guidelines is one of the attributes of trustworthy guidelines. So those are a variety of sort of national, international things that's a potpourri that I know a little bit about and that we could talk more about if people wanted to. Now, the next slide, please. These are some local things, okay, that have been done, and where I guess I have one more to add onto this. These are some people in the local environment who've already done this, okay, and would be useful resources for other people to talk to. And I see one of them's already on the phone. Jennifer, you on the phone?
I am. Hi.
Oh,
that's a nice surprise.
Yeah, well, I hope I may have gotten it wrong too. So I'm glad you're going to be here to double check it. But Barbara Vickery and Eric Chen. When they were developing quality indicators for multiple sclerosis, they actually had two groups of I don't want to call them technical experts, but they had two panels, okay? And the first panel was to come up with what the relevant domains are. What are the relevant domains that quality indicators should be developed for? And that process included some clinicians, but it also included payers. So I think Kathy McLean was on that from WellPoint, and maybe one or two others. And it also included people with multiple sclerosis, okay? So patients. I believe there were three patients on that panel of about maybe 11 people. And what was interesting was that the patients tended to rate some outcomes differentially to sort of the providers, okay, and the payers, and so there definitely was a signal in that study, which is written up, where patients had different. I mean, there were, you know, the data were collected via standard, you know, RAND UCLA appropriateness method, you know, rating 1 to 9 kind of a thing with discussion, but the patients definitely rated some of the outcomes systematically different than the other people, and they were a valuable input to it. And Jennifer, since I didn't know all these folks as well, but in the urinary incontinence one, there were those two or three women, and I think they were patients, maybe they were also providers, but they definitely shut down the rest of the group on that about the one outcome in terms of trying to preserve sexual function in older women. Do you remember?
Right, right.
Yeah. Were those guys patients?
No, they were urogynecologists.
Yeah, okay, but they were women and they were reporting patients it was a very clear distinction between the women, okay, and the men. Okay. that were on that panel, and it went exactly the opposite of the way that you might have predicted a priori, and so that was another signal where patient may be coming up with a systematic difference from what providers might have done this. So that shouldn't say patient involvement, but a patient proxy involvement there. Mm-hmm. And then in something that Paul Chung and Tamani Coker have recently done, that involved practice redesign for well-child visits, and that involved the actual clinics that are thinking about doing this thing, in addition to other experts as well. And of course, a big part of that has to do with do they think that this is important to their practice? Do they think that what's being proposed is something that they can do? And things like that. So these are all things that have been done in the local environment, which I think are certainly a step above probably what a lot of other people are just starting to think about. And if I had to summarize sort of these experiences over these years, it's as follows. The first is that nobody's an expert in this. Okay, I'm not an expert in this. It feels uncomfortable for me to be billed in this noon talk as if I'm an expert in this, because I don't feel like an expert in it. But I think there's probably nobody who's an expert in it, because I don't think that it's really, I don't think that anybody has done it enough, and I don't think the science of knowing how to do this, okay, is sufficiently advanced that that people could say, this is the right way. I think that there's enough information to say this is the wrong way, and some of the wrong ways, I would think, would be just leaving stakeholders out entirely. Obviously, you know, that's a pretty simple wrong way. And I would say something else that certainly in my experience over these 20 years is, I think it is also is you want to avoid just one of a kind stakeholder. Okay, so I think that you really need at least two of a kind for stakeholders, and preferably three of a kind for stakeholders. And I understand that explodes the, you know, the size of the people that you have to collect this from, but I'm afraid that you people are just going to have to bite the bullet on that one and do it, because I just don't think that the diversity of stakeholder input from any individual stakeholder group can be captured with a single person there. So I would think that I think the other thing that we can successfully generalize from these experiences is that I think the stakeholders are most important at a couple of different places. The first is sort of what are the important questions to them, and the corollary to that is what are the important outcomes. I mean, those are obviously related questions. And so what are the important questions and outcomes of interest to these stakeholders? Then there's sort of all the scientific stuff that goes on. So in terms of, you know, what Tim was talking about, doing the systematic review, or in terms of some of the things that are up on this thing, developing the, you know, we tried to have the patient in the old HCPR back pain thing rate specific aspects of medical care. Okay, you know, like, you know, given this situation, you know, should clinicians do X or Y? And the guy just threw up his hands. He said, "You guys are the doctors, okay? That's not my role." So my guess is that the stakeholders, most of the stakeholders that would be relevant here aren't going to be involved in the technical details of the practice guideline development or of a systematic review or the scientific aspects of what's going on. But they're crucial in terms of what are the key questions, are these important, what are the outcomes that are important. And then, at the far end, after you've produced it, okay, is do they understand what this is and can they use it? And so something that I forgot to put on this thing was our work with the patient safety practice stakeholder group, which is this group of 20-some-odd people that spans the UK and Canada and the US. And although it doesn't include any patients per se, it includes people from healthcare chains that have to implement patient safety practice. It includes regulators. It includes methodologists. It includes developers of patient safety practice things. And when we met last year in Washington to present some of the results of this sort of massive review of various different patient safety practices, I mean, a couple of the guys said, "Listen, you know, you're presenting this, but you're presenting this in a way that we cannot use this information. And so you need to be able to come up with a way that presents to us what it is that we can do, what it is that we shouldn't do, and what it is that, you know, is still remains to be determined." And it was. I mean, we thought we'd produce something that easily would have gotten published in a major academic journal, but it was very helpful to hear these, and it was from several different of these guys, so it was a consistent message saying that the way you're presenting this information is not going to be useful to us people that actually have to do these things out in these community hospitals. And so I think that that's the other place that stakeholders are really valuable, is that once you've sort of got something to show them, can they say, do we understand it? Can we use it? And if not, you know, how can you do something to make it better? So anyway, let me stop there, you know, with sort of this potpourri of things and open it up to Nazlene or whomever to ask questions.
Thank you, Paul. I just want to say, in addition to just answering questions about your talk, if we could just have a general discussion about ways to move forward to support potentially stronger proposals with the CTSI on stakeholder engagement components, things like that. We want to get some practical guidelines from this.
Right, so if I was just going to just close at that, I'd say have more than one of each kind of stakeholder, okay? Have it outlined exactly the types of information you're going to want to collect from them, and then use some kind of formal process to collect it. Okay, if I was going to say something that would put you at least in the midpoint and probably ahead of the pack, I would do those three things.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
So this is Jonas. I have a question, Paul, that I'd just be interested in your thoughts on. It seems like one of the most important things in going into this is to have an idea as to the extent of potential variations in perspective on a particular issue in order to anticipate how much how many different stakeholders are really needed. I mean, in addition to sort of traditional demographic issues of age, race, sex, etc., when one starts to think about things like disability and disutility, profession, quality of life issues, depending on the question that's being asked and the domain that it falls in, the scope of what sort of participation is needed really is likely to vary. So what are your thoughts on good ways to really estimate that in advance and then develop the sort of number and extent of stakeholders?
Yeah, well, no good ways, okay? I mean, we look for that kind of stuff in, and you know, when we do our evidence reviews all the time, so, you know, things like, you know, what are the, you know, what values do patients place on different, you know, outcomes? And except in a few areas where it's been, you know, obviously a lot of work's been done and there's a lot of development, mostly that stuff's not there, all right? And we fall back on, you know, we don't really know, and so we're just going to use rules of thumb in order to figure out who to get involved in this. And so you'd wish or you'd hope, and maybe PCORI is going to, you know, years from now, have produced, the kinds of evidence base where you'll be able to look this kind of stuff up, just like you would be able to look up, for how many urologic procedures were done, you know, of a particular kind on patients within a certain age in various geographic areas around the country. We don't know that, and we don't know how it varies by geography. We don't know, we know a little bit, but little about how it varies by gender and race. I wish there was a good way to do that, Jonas, but I don't know of one.
Paul, this is Brian Mitt, but I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding either the question or the answer, but it sounds to me like you're not answering the specific question. I don't know that we need to know what the variation is in order to decide how many patients are needed. What we need to know is what the key dimensions or trade-offs are, and it seems to me that that can be known in advance. So if you know that there are two or three different treatment options, and they have, you know, various quality versus quantity or length of life aspects and trade-offs, Jonas, is that what you're getting at, that you need to identify those kinds of trade-offs in order to understand how many patient perspectives are needed?
Well, I mean, I think the question that I was asking is to understand the extent of perspectives, but I think you're asking an important corollary, which is if one can anticipate the degree of possible variables one can tinker with in advance, and then maybe it doesn't make a difference what the spectrum is and how many different directions it can run in terms of people's opinions about it.
Yeah, Brian, I wasn't interpreting his question that way, and I was interpreting it more along the lines of the following. If we're going to bring together clinicians, okay, to discuss this, we know that we need some academic clinicians and some community clinicians. We know we need some providers of the kind who provide the procedure versus people that don't provide the procedure. We know that we need to include people from different geographical areas in the country, because there's an empirical evidence base that all those people bring systematic differences to the table. And at least that's what I thought Jonas was asking, is do we know how many different kinds of stakeholders within a group need to be brought in there in order to capture that kind of variance? And I don't think we know any of that.
It does point out an interesting difference between the clinicians versus the patients. And actually, Paul, putting the other two things you'd said earlier, is it oversimplifying to say that for the most part we would expect the patient stakeholders to be more interested in outcomes and helping to identify the important outcomes, whereas the clinician stakeholders are more interested in the comparators and the questions? So if a patient just wants to know, you know, what should I do or what's likely to be best for me, the patients have no idea what the different treatment options are. The clinicians are those who are faced with the decision of choosing between A, B, and C.
Yeah, possibly. Another thing I left off this list was some autism work that was done over at RAND, and that was mostly done by Margaret Maglione, but I was actually helping moderate the meeting of the stakeholders on that. And there, I mean, as you can imagine, there's a lot of stakeholders with a lot of vested interest about particular things for autism patients, mainly, you know, their children or the children of other people who are important to them. And there, they do know exactly what the procedure is, and they don't want to hear that you know, a case series of three, you know, which reported benefits is not going to make the grade for evidence here. They get very upset about that. And so I don't know the answer, Brian. I think that that's probably a general truism, what you just said, but I think that there's going to be places where it probably there's exceptions to that rule.
And these factors also help determine how many stakeholders you need from each group at the table, given that level of engagement and lack of consensus.
Yeah, and there I don't have a scientific way to do it. My rule of thumb is 3.
So this is Mike Ong, and you know, I think that after hearing you talk, Paul, and also listening to Tim, the hard thing about doing a lot of these patient involvement or patient involvement things or stakeholder involvement, at least when we've been doing some of it related to heart failure, it takes a lot of time and to get people all at the table and get them organized. And given what if we're thinking ahead to the CORI and given how rapid some of these things are, there's no way that we're going to be able to do one-offs every single time to try to get stakeholders engaged. And I'm just wondering, is this something where we just need to have some type of other alternate mechanism to try to get people's opinions, whether it's through crowdsourcing, which would be a lot easier.
Through what? Crowdsourcing? Oh, okay.
Yeah, particularly, I mean, if you're thinking that we have to get things across geographical locations, it's one thing it's hard enough to get people together in L.A., you know, let alone, you know, try to figure out how to do it nationally. So, you know, I think, again, and we're all stumbling our way forward, I don't know if you have any thoughts as to the ways to create a sort of stable group of patients or people who are trained, because it is going to take a while to particularly train patients to be part of these stakeholder groups.
Totally agree, Mike. And all that business about the AHRQ effective healthcare program and the thing goes up for public comment and then the protocol is public comment, that has taken a systematic review process that used to take about 9 months and turned it into something that's more like 18 months. Okay, as there's just all these levels of review that you're just sitting around, you know, and then you get back a gazillion comments. Many of them are completely, you know, self-serving or off base. And so the timing on this is a big challenge. Since the UCLA CTSI is focused on Los Angeles, I don't think it's unreasonable at all to start thinking about, can we come up with a group of, you know, 20 or 30, you know, kinds of, you know, I mean, not 100, but not 5, okay, you know, stakeholders that we can get this kind of rapid feedback from. And just realize that this is, you're always going to be trading off some diversity for stability. But if you need it to turn around fast, I think that having a group that's engaged, that knows what to expect, okay, and, you know, and knows that if they get an email about X, that, you know, they need to get back to you in a couple of days about it, I think that would be a very reasonable thing to try out.
I think that raises the issue of sort of at what point does training stakeholders become a professionalization of sorts, in which case you sort of have to go back to the question of what is the value or what is the role of the patient input.
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying there. You know, have you just co-opted these people into the machine then? But all I can tell you is, if I were a PCORI reviewer and reviewing something, I would think that if somebody had if somebody was willing to try out putting together a standing panel of representative stakeholders that they could then go back to over and over and over again, I would look at that very favorably, as opposed to a whole series of one-off things, which I would think are not feasible.
And I guess just a sort of follow-up question, this is more just a query, in terms of sort of collaborating with stakeholders, the issue of compensation, I don't know if that's something that's sort of fits into kind of ongoing development of how to sort of involve stakeholders, but sort of whether sort of to financially compensate for participation, given that this isn't their primary occupation.
Yeah, we haven't thought about that. I mean, it raises an additional issue, and I suppose not dissimilar to that goes with subjects being involved in research studies. But I hope that would be minor compared to the desire to get their input into the process. So, I mean, I would hope that compensation issues would not be something that would make or break a grant application.
This is Lenore. Thought marking, Paul, if we're really at the level of intensity of engagement that it sounds to me PCORI's asking for, and that is more than asking the stakeholders for opinions or feedback, but actually this authentic partnership where they're at the table, the design table. And I think they actually expressly say that the level of engagement should also be indicated by how the funding is distributed to the stakeholders, as well as any academic partners and other community partners in the proposal.
I didn't interpret that though as meaning do you pay the stakeholders. I thought that meant more along the lines of if we're going to do a study that's going to look at practice redesign at some community facilities, that the community facilities got to be getting some of the money, or at least got to be at the table to figure out how the money's going to be allocated.
Paul, it's Martin.
Hi, Martin.
The question about stakeholders, and just hearing you talk about autism makes me wonder, should there really be people, public representatives, which seems like a good idea in such a process, but should they be people who have a stake in the outcome?
This is the problem, isn't it? So that when you get patient, if you're going to include patient perspectives from the patient advocacy groups, the upside is that they're pretty familiar with the process. They know the medical lingo. There's not a lot of, you don't have to go through a big training exercise. But the downside is they're usually coming in with a really focused interest on a few specific things. And I don't know. I mean, that's a trade-off that has to be considered for each individual topic. And so if you take something like autism, there are a lot of different therapies and a lot of different stakeholder groups that have interests about particular therapies. And if you start when you start including, do you have to include somebody from everybody, I guess is the question. And do you have, and then what happens, let's say there's four different stakeholder groups about a particular condition, and they represent 100,000, 10,000, 1,000, and 10 different members. Okay, do they all get equal representation?
No.
I was on something. I was a member of a group. I was a stakeholder on a group that was dealing with chiropractic integration into the VA. And there's like five different chiropractic professional organizations, and they literally have a distribution of membership, something about like what I said, and they all got one person at the table. So that you had a guy who was representing 10 people, equivalent to a guy who was representing 50,000. So I don't know how to deal with that, Martin. Those are like issues that are two steps down the line from where I think the science is at.
Oh, no. Well, the IBF conference is...
This is Robin. I just want to give a little bit of a story to the challenges we faced getting recruiting for our two panels for our PCORI project. Huh? So we're trying to get stakeholders, patients, and staff members from community health centers, and our main stakeholder partner is the California Primary Care Association, which represents all the community health centers within the state, and all those community health centers have boards that are supposed to have a majority, 51% or more, composed of patients. So despite having fairly good sequence of ties that would indicate a good chance to recruit a lot of patients and other stakeholders, it's taken several months of full-time effort by my marvelous project director, Ann, here, and a lot of effort on the behalf of the California Primary Care Association, just to identify patients, but identify staff. The problems are that patients are, you know, we're trying to get distribution from across the state, from rural, from urban areas, trying to get, they're participating on panels so they can actually speak and read the literature reviews, and so speak in English and participate in the panels, that they're able to travel to Sacramento to participate on the panels. And then for the staff members, that they can actually, that their health centers can spare their, them leaving for a day, that they don't actually have to take a vacation day. There are a lot of challenges to putting this together, this panel together, despite having very good ties with stakeholder groups.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible logistic challenge. And what questions are you asking them? What are they going to be dealing with?
This going to be dealing with these non-medical services that the community health centers deliver.
Yeah, and so then there's any question, is it, I mean, you know, going back to something that Mike or somebody brought up, is there any ability then to, once the, I mean, you know, you're the first guy here, and so you're having to engage all these guys. But once you've engaged all these guys, is there going to be some opportunity to then, you know, make them available, or will they be willing to be available for future projects so that the next person and the next person and the next person after that has a steadily building up group of potential stakeholders who already kind of are familiar with the process, and you're not starting from ground zero every single time.
Right. Once we actually talk, get the people on the phone and talk with them, they could be more excited about participating. So I think that they definitely would, over time, want to do that. It's just the question is getting, you know, past emails and getting, actually getting people to get on the phone in the first place.
Yeah, and the only experience that I have with something like that, and it's not about patient stakeholders, but we are involved in doing regular surveillance of AHRQ's entire stable of comparative effectiveness reports. And so what that requires us to do is, on an every 6 month basis, is that we're asking various experts in whatever the field is, you know, does this still seem like it's, you know, up to date or out of date, or is there new evidence, etc. And so the first time that we do this, you know, we send out a lot of requests and we don't get very many back, but the next time we do it, the guys that answered the first time, they answer the second time, and they do it quickly. We've definitely seen an advantage to being able to use the same people over and over again. Again, with all the good and the bad that comes, the good obviously is that you have an engaged group and you get quick responses and you can turn things around faster.
This is Jody Samuels. I'm actually with the California Primary Care Association, so we are the ones who are partnering with Robin and Anne. And just to sort of address your point about trying to sort of create a stable of folks who we might be able to draw on later, that's certainly one of the things that we're hoping will come out of this, because we know that as the Primary Care Association, having those connections to the community health centers could be a real asset. And we are just sort of starting to get our feet wet in terms of doing these types of research projects and being a partner. So it's definitely something we're interested in pursuing and in trying to to be able to do that and be that type of partner for future research projects as well.
Martin again. So it seems like a stakeholder could be a person who has a particular perspective on a condition or a medical situation because they're afflicted by it or they know someone who is. Or it could be someone who might not be like that person at all but has knowledge or sophistication about this kind of a condition. Or a stakeholder might be someone who is the kind of person who's going to have to pay for the cost of whatever gets done, you know, because they are an insured individual, or perhaps representing people who have that perspective. And is it the case that the stakeholders who get involved tend to be more in the first of these three groups, that is, representing the interests of those with a particular perspective on the disease?
Well, that's the part that it's going to be harder to build a standing group about, unless you are doing the same disease over and over again. But, I mean, as somebody was just saying about the primary care networks and that kind of thing, I think that there you have much more opportunity to build on past projects in terms of those kinds of things. But I agree, you know, if you're doing autism this week and you're doing heart disease next week and then you're doing a glaucoma the week after that, those are going to be pretty much starting from scratch every single time.
Well, we're at the end of our discussion, but thank you so much, Paul, for sticking around and answering questions.
You bet. And again, apologies because I don't really consider myself an expert in this. Anyway, that's been my experiences in this area.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, bye bye, everybody.
Thank you. You all.